The Capital Ideas podcast now has a new monthly edition hosted by Capital Group CEO Mike Gitlin. Investment professionals reveal their best mentors, how they find their next great idea, and a few funny stories. Subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. American Funds Distributors, Inc.
From the opinion pages of the Wall Street Journal, this is Potomac Watch.
The House is on the verge of passing its $1.9 trillion COVID bill. As President Trump prepares to give a speech at a conservative conference this weekend. Welcome, I'm Kyle Peterson with the Wall Street Journal. We're joined today by my colleagues, WSJ columnists Kim Strassel and Bill McGurn. Democrats in the House, according to all the news reports, they're planning to vote Friday on their COVID bill. And we talked earlier this week about some of the details of what's in the bill. But how about the politics? So here's a headline Wednesday from the group Morning Consult. It's, quote, with congressional stimulus fight looming, 76% of voters back $1.9 trillion plan, including 60% of Republicans, unquote. So, Bill, do you think Republicans are taking a bit of a political risk in opposing this across the board as they are?
Yes, they are taking a political risk in doing it, but I think that it's a risk that they have to take, and I think it's better to take it early. You know, there were some of those same arguments about Obamacare, you know, that they would be punished for not supporting Obamacare. And I think there's a lot of substantive reasons to wonder. I mean, I think we'd be better off without the bill, even though it does deliver some relief to some people. But I don't think it's going to do as much as, say, concentrating on reopening and so forth would do. So the Republicans have to, you know, get their sea legs again and show what they stand for. And I think a lot of people have big questions about all this spending and whether it's really going to solve the problems that it's meant to solve.
Yeah, I mean, it strikes me that the framing here really works to Democrats' benefit in that we're in the middle of this pandemic and they're the ones saying we've got to do something. Bill mentioned Obamacare, but I think also of the 2009 stimulus, where that was another crisis situation. And Republicans spent the years after the passage of the stimulus reminding people about all the flaws about the things that were in it. And I mean, it seems to me that that could occur here too. The CBO is saying there's $130 billion or so allocated in the bill for schools. And the CBO is saying that all of that money won't be spent until 2028. And so, Kim, I mean, that strikes me as a rich vein for Republicans. They'll, as that money goes out and during the 2024 election, they will be surely reminding people that it was part of this COVID emergency bill.
Yeah, correct. And I think you're right to bring up that history of the Obama stimulus, because how times have changed. I still remember as that bill was being pushed through Congress at rapid speed, everyone warning that Republicans would be punished for not going along with it because obviously the economy was in such a mess and this needed to happen. In fact, now does anybody look back and go, wow, that was such a great piece of legislation and it saved the economy? Obviously not. People talk about bailouts. They talk about Solyndra, all the money that was thrown at all of these terrible projects and lost taxpayers a boodle. And so I think that there's going to be a lot of things in this bill that as we move out of that crisis stage, as you said, Kyle, that there's going to be more opportunity for people to focus on. And schools are a good example because, in essence, that $130 billion, given that it's not going to be spent for time, is essentially it's like a payoff to teachers' unions, because you know that the money is going to be ended up using to pad teachers' salaries. And this comes at a moment when there is rising anger across the country about teachers' failure to get back in the classroom and all the damage has been done to kids. So that's just one example, but there are pension bailouts in here. There's the money that's going to go to the states and you can manage the mismanagement. Some of that is going to see. So I think that there's going to be opportunity for the GOP to say, look, we stood for some fiscal responsibility and common sense here. And look what happened when we were ignored.
On the other side of the aisle, the bill in the House still includes this $15 minimum wage provision. And is it a mistake not to have taken that out? I mean, there it clearly faces obstacles in the Senate, parliamentary obstacles, you know, even Democratic senators who say they will not vote for it. So, Bill, I mean, is Nancy Pelosi making a mistake, since this appears not to be fated to become law, in forcing her moderate members to vote for something as a sort of a signal?
Yeah, that's a good argument. I mean, my suspicion is I can't read Nancy Pelosi's mind, but you know, until the Senate parliamentarian ruled that, you know, this is sort of outside reconciliation, there was a good chance it might go in, because quite a few senators wanted it in. Mrs. Pelosi clearly wanted it in. I think it was a pressure point for her, because it also put pressure on the Senate parliamentarian this way. Now, as you know, the Democrats could still override that, but that raises it to another level. The costs go up, the political costs go up if they do it that way. And clearly, that's not what they would like to do, you know, and that's why they've dropped it. So it could be a mistake, but I think she saw it. This she's going to put whatever pressure she can, and you know, she's not been shy about holding her caucus to votes and so forth. And she was pushing for it, and she seemed to have lost a little battle. I'm not sure the war is completely lost yet, though.
Well, the news from the Senate on Thursday and Friday is this ruling by the Senate parliamentarian, who essentially said that the $15 minimum wage is not a budget item. It doesn't belong in a budget reconciliation bill. It may have some fiscal effects, but that's not the general thrust of that policy. And Kim, I mean, many Democrats are saying they disagree with that ruling. They're upset about that ruling, but that was pretty expected, no?
Absolutely. Look, one of the reasons we have the Byrd rule is that you're not just supposed to throw straight up policy into this reconciliation process. It's supposed to go through the regular Senate order, where it is subject to a filibuster. The Byrd rule was created precisely to make sure that you didn't sneak things like this into pure budget discussions, given the lower threshold of only 50 votes. So no one should be surprised by this. Even the press was all noting the minute that they decided to put the minimum wage in that it was unlikely to pass muster with the Senate parliamentarian. And that's why I personally think what Nancy Pelosi is doing here is quite risky, because she's now said that even though the parliamentarian has ruled, she's going to keep it in the legislation that they pass in the House. What that means is it's going to go to the Senate, and it's pretty unlikely that moderates like Joe Manchin or Kyrsten Sinema are going to vote to overrule the parliamentarian. And that means that the version passed in the Senate is going to be different than the House. And so it's going to have to go back to the House for a vote. And at this point, Nancy Pelosi, by encouraging everyone to, you know, the progressives in her party gave a press conference this morning all saying it has to be in there. And we can't just let these Senate rules dictate what we do and how we help the country. So assuming that the Senate doesn't bow to them, it's going to come back. And then Nancy Pelosi's in this situation where, does she lose progressives on this vote? She only has a 5-vote margin over there. She can only afford to lose 5 people. Now, her moderates have all stepped in line for a bill that many of them thought was too large. But will progressives be as compliant? And is she risking getting this across the finish line?
Hang tight. We'll be right back. You're listening to Potomac Watch from the Wall Street Journal.
This episode is brought to you by Vanta. Managing the requirements for modern security programs is increasingly challenging. Vanta's trust management platform helps you quickly assess risk, streamline security reviews, and automate compliance for SOC 2, ISO 27001, and more. Plus, save time by completing security questionnaires with Vanta AI. Learn how by watching Vanta's on-demand demo at vanta.com/WSJ. That's vanta.com/WSJ.
From the opinion pages of the Wall Street Journal, this is Potomac Watch.
Welcome back. It's an interesting question. And then meanwhile, if you're a Republican candidate who is planning to run against one of these moderate Democrats in 2022, you're probably already getting ready to cut the ads saying that A $15 minimum wage would be a job killer in our area, and this representative voted for it. And I think Kim raises an interesting point here that Nancy Pelosi having this in the bill has raised the appetites of the progressives in the Senate and in the House. So here's some of the reaction to the parliamentarian's ruling on it. Ilhan Omar said, replace the parliamentarian. What's a Democratic majority if we can't pass our priority bills? This is unacceptable. Congressman Ro Khanna said, I'm sorry, an unelected parliamentarian does not get to deprive 32 million Americans of the raise they deserve. And Bill, I understand the point that the amount of power that this strange reconciliation process puts into the unelected hands of the Senate parliamentarian, but that's the process. That's the budget rules as they exist.
Yes, and those rules, again, remember, reconciliation is allowed, but it's considered, it's not considered the normal way you do business, right? And that's why when you go around the normal process, these other rules are designed to safeguard them. As Kim said, they're designed to prevent people from abusing it, which is why, budget reconciliation is supposed to be limited to the budget and things that have a direct concern. Because once you open the door on something like this, it's hard to see how there's anything that could be considered outside the process. So I do think they're vulnerable. It's interesting to me because looking at Mrs. Pelosi and how she's put her members in this position, it strikes me that Mitch McConnell in the Senate operates the other way. He tries to keep people out of things if they don't have to do it, if he doesn't see a way forward. Now, maybe he's too cautious on some areas, but I think he proceeds by trying to spare people of votes that may be used against them later on. Sometimes you can't do it. The dilemma that Mrs. Pelosi has had for a while is that the progressives dominate her party now, but they don't dominate the country to the degree that progressives alone would give her a majority in the House. So she needs these other votes. And we've seen what happened in the last election. She lost quite a few of them. And if she loses more, the Democrats lose their majority. So it's a really high-stakes gamble.
So where do the Democrats go from here? I mean, here was the rest of what Congressman Ro Khanna said. He said, this is an advisory, not a ruling. VP Harris needs to disregard and rule the $15 minimum wage in order, unquote. So, Kim, essentially, if you get down that road, then whatever the vice president thinks is a budget item is a budget item. And Joe Biden, the Senate institutionalist, I mean, his team is already signaling that they don't think this is a good idea.
Right. So, and it was good to see Joe Biden's team come out and say that, because they're headed for a real mess here, because those who want Kamala Harris to step in and do that, that's not the end of the kind of decision. What ends up happening is that you can come in and you can say, well, I'm overruling, but then the Republicans would have the opportunity to basically call a point of order on the floor and then have a vote on this. And the thing that we've got is, look, Kyrsten Sinema, the Democrat from Arizona, put out an exceptionally strong statement saying not only that would she not rule, like vote to overrule the parliamentarian, she doesn't think minimum wage should be in there anyway. And Manchin has also, Joe Manchin from West Virginia, has quite strongly said that he has no intention of breaking the Byrd rule. He actually sits in the seat held once by the senator who's it's named after, Robert Byrd. And so you're not going to have the number of people that you need to overrule the parliamentarian. So it's not the end of it. And, the progressives may not like this. But the argument that they are generally advancing is we have a majority and therefore we should be able to push through anything we want. And sorry, that's just not been how it's working in this country for a long time. We have this filibuster and we have a Byrd rule that's designed to protect the filibuster in the reconciliation process. And so what we have at the moment, and it's good to see, is that a bipartisan group of senators have decided they're not going to throw that entire system over for raw power.
And in recognition of some of these procedural realities, there are other Democratic senators who are essentially moving to Plan B and trying to find other ways to get at this issue. So Bernie Sanders is one of them. He said he's working on an amendment to take tax deductions away from large profitable corporations that don't pay workers at least $15. Another one is Senator Ron Wyden. Here's what he said. My plan would impose a 5% penalty on a big corporation's total payroll if any workers earn less than a certain amount. That penalty would increase over time, unquote. So, I mean, Bill, what do you make of these ways to get at a $15 minimum wage without actually being able to impose one?
Well, we're gonna see where they go on. And I mean, I think that if there's an effort to do a clean standalone minimum wage, they might be able to get it if it's a lot lower, if it's closer to the Joe Manchin territory. I think they would get even some Republican votes for it. I'm of the view that the proper minimum wage is zero, but mine is a distinctly minority view. Of $15 an hour used to be considered, pretty high and pretty extreme. And now the argument seems to be that there are absolutely no costs to doing this. So why wouldn't we do it? And if that's the case, why not put it at $20 or something? I don't know that it's going to survive all these kind of gimmicky arguments for it.
I would just throw in too that remember, amendments to this reconciliation process also have to pass muster with the Senate parliamentarian. And just as a practical level, if you couldn't get what was essentially a government policy change about the minimum wage past the Senate parliamentarian, it's an even harder stretch to get an amendment passed that is aimed at corporations, that truly, like, this is a policy issue aimed at corporations that doesn't seem to affect the U.S. budget at all. It's actually penalizing corporations. So that could be an even harder lift than the pure minimum wage proposal.
Yeah, I mean, I guess I don't know the ins and outs of the Byrd rule that well. It seems to me that if you are taking away tax deductions from businesses that meet certain criteria, that at least looks to me like a more direct budgetary effect than the actual $15 minimum wage. But the other problem I see with it is you still then need to get Joe Manchin and Kyrsten Sinema on board with that, Kim. And if Joe Manchin says, I'm not going to vote for a $15 minimum wage, I have a hard time seeing him turning around and voting for a $15 provision where you lose your tax deductions if you don't hit that. I mean, I think that he and his voters would see that as largely the same thing.
Yeah, with the caveat that, look, Bernie Sanders is very clever here, and he's got a group of people that he has hired that are very familiar with the Byrd rule, and there is that. So this could be very focused in doing this. Your point, though, about Manchin, I do think that there is one thing, is that what Bernie Sanders is doing with this proposal and Joe Wyden, they are walking a little bit toward the Manchin position, in that they're talking about aiming this at big companies. Manchin's view, his argument, and he needs to talk more about this. We don't entirely understand where he is. He sort of has said that he thinks, well, about what West Virginia's minimum wage is, $11. But that is driven very much by concern that many members have about smaller businesses, of which there are many in West Virginia. So could he be maneuvered into a position where he allowed a vote on something, or went along with a vote that only seemed to impact major, Fortune 500 companies? Maybe. I don't know. We haven't really heard him talk much on that.
Yeah, that's an interesting point, though. It still seems to me, Bill, that it doesn't quite solve the Manchin problem, because even if you're only applying it to, like, let's say, national grocery chains, national pharmacy chains, I mean, there's still a matter of the difference in the cost of living in these places. You know, the national chain might have employees in Manhattan and employees in the middle of nowhere in West Virginia. And the idea of treating those labor markets the same, I think, still gets to the problem that Joe Manchin has with this idea in the first place.
Yeah, I think you're absolutely right there. And course, he's raised the profile of the issue in that direction, too, so that if it passes, then, you know, they're saying, well, he was kind of a sellout because he didn't stick to the position. You know, I think Joe Manchin has real concerns about the impact of a $15 minimum wage in West Virginia, knowing that the cost of living is a lot lower there. So the impact on employers would be large as the price of labor would go up considerably. So I'm with you. I don't think that these things in the end, that's what I meant by saying they're gimmicks, they really solve the problem. If the wage is too high, I mean, there are two problems. One is, you know, the parliamentarians issue that this really shouldn't be handled in a reconciliation bill. And the other, that some people worry that setting it too high is really going to do a lot of damage. And I'm not sure that any of the proposed solutions, though they sound like they run around it, really do. They don't fix the fundamental problem, the two problems. One is people don't think it should be part of this reconciliation package, that the package should be limited to COVID relief, or two, that it's going to have a damaging effect on their home states and economies.
Finally, President Trump is set to speak this weekend at the Conservative Political Action Conference, CPAC. This will be his first big event since leaving office. And Kim, I mean, what do you suppose he will say in this speech to the extent that any Trump speech can be predicted in advance?
Well, we are getting some early intel about what that speech may be focused on. And it sounds as though a significant portion of it, at least as written, because I think that's the good point, is that often what's on the teleprompter is not in the end what a Trump speech looks like. But as written, it seems to spend a significant amount of time going after Biden, his first months, talking about some of Trump's prior achievements, making that contrast. I generally think that's a pretty productive way to do it. It does sound as though he is going to talk about the future of the Republican Party and the conservative movement, his American First agenda, and where the party should be going. And that it sounds as though he's going to call out what he is labeling, you know, Washington insiders, Washington elites within his own party. And it's going to be really interesting to see where that goes and whether or not this stokes that civil war people are talking about, or if it's got a tone that's designed to say, look, these people are a problem, but we all need to come together. And it's just unclear where that will go.
Yeah, the ratio between those two will be fascinating. I mean, for the party that's out of power, going after the people who are in power is generally a pretty uniting way to approach it. But the question always with Trump, Bill, to me is, I mean, how many elbows and how hard are they going to be thrown at people like Liz Cheney or people like Mitch McConnell?
Well, that's exactly the question. Look, I'm very interested to see what he would say. I need to make a confession that I actually met my wife at CPAC back in 1992, so I'm very familiar with its history. It's basically a platform, right? I mean, it doesn't decide any votes or so forth, but the reason politicians love it is that it's generally an enthusiastic platform for Republicans and conservatives. And the question is whether Trump will, it seems to me the question is he going to look to the future, or is he going to look to the past, which means grievances? And one of the things that I think he could do, I do think that he has a list of achievements that he should be proud about, but they're Republican achievements. And I'm not sure Trump, even though he has a high standing now in the party, could go into the next primary session, even if he's still leading, and win running against both the Democrats and the Republicans, or at least those he believes sabotaged him. I think he has to define something more positive if he's going to do it. I think people get tired of complaints over the years. So I'll be very curious to see if he's able to define it. You know, he never really defined Trumpism. It was more a personality thing. There were different aspects that I liked: the deregulation, the tax cuts, the good judges, the move of the embassy, a lot of stuff that was good, but it never really was defined. And I think that if he's going to go forward, he needs to do something like that. I think he could do it. I'm not sure that he will.
But it does, one last thought, it does make for an interesting dynamic in that a former president has a big microphone just by virtue of being a former president. And normally when a president leaves office, he generally goes pretty quiet and lets his successor wishes his successor the best. But in my working lifetime, I mean, there hasn't been a one-term president, Kim, and particularly not one who was trying to decide whether to run for a second term after his successor's first term. So it's a fascinating bit of history to watch play out.
Right. And you can imagine that the people who will be watching this most intently are those Republicans who you can already see are laying the groundwork for a potential presidential run themselves in 2024, whether that be Ted Cruz or Josh Hawley or Nikki Haley or, you know, maybe some of the governors out there. You know, we've watched a lot of them trying to develop their own version of kind of that Trump populism, one that fits them. But they're going to be watching to see what kind of hints he gives about 2024. And that is a really big question. Donald Trump has a big choice to make here. He can go through that process again. And no doubt part of him would really love that. He loves to be in that position in the center of attention. On the other hand, he could step back and understand that he has the potential to be a real kingmaker. And so maybe we'll get some first hints of which way he is leaning at CPAC this weekend.
Thank you, Kim and Bill. Thank you all for listening. We'll be back next week with another edition of Potomac Watch.
This message comes from Viking, committed to exploring the world in comfort. Journey through the heart of Europe on an elegant Viking longship with thoughtful service, destination-focused dining, and cultural enrichment on board and on shore. And every Viking voyage is all-inclusive with no children and no casinos. Discover more at Viking.com.